I was born in Australia. Both my father and mother came from County Antrim. The most significant point of that is that my father died a few weeks or at most a month or two after my birth. And then my mother took me back to Ireland. But to return for a moment to my father, he was a figure who haunted my whole childhood and youth, because he was never mentioned in our household. And as I grew older, this began to obsess me, and I wondered why he wasn't mentioned. And it always seemed to me there must have been something shameful about him, or at least about his death. And when I learned somewhat later what it was, that he had died of alcoholic poisoning, and possibly, although even to this day I'm not sure of that, killed himself, that, of course, had an effect on, I think, really the rest of my life, that as was only natural, I began to sympathize with this strange, unknown outcast. And it may have influenced me in my writing later, which became more and more writing about outcasts, or from an outcast to outcasts. But as I say, I came back to Ireland with my mother. We lived mostly in Antrim, but to some extent in County Meath. There was nothing very memorable about my earlier years. Later, I was sent to an English public school. That had a considerable effect on me. I think in those days, an English public school was a pretty strict institution, not to say, in fact, somewhat savage in its curriculum and methods, so much so that in after years I have experienced other institutions. I've been in various prisons, Irish and foreign, and in some ways I think my experience at Rugby School had toughened me sufficiently that these later prison experiences became, I won't say that they weren't pretty horrible, but I could endure them, partly due perhaps to my experience of an English public school in the, well, I went there in 1916, I think, and stayed there 3 or 4 years, and they were a pretty good discipline. Speaking of 1916, it may be worth remarking that when I went back to Rugby after the Easter holidays in 1916, although I was from Northern Irish parents, knew nothing about nationalism or Irish republicanism, the 1916 rebellion had, of course, I won't say of course, but it had inspired me, and I went back there already something of a rebel, although I didn't know about what. And myself and a few others, funnily, at the school, one or two Irish, but a Polish friend, we became quite intransigent about rebellions in general. And then when we heard the news very shortly afterwards, I suppose a few months or a year afterwards, of the Russian Revolution, that inflamed us even more. And from then on, I was inspired by not only the Irish, not only by Pierce and MacDonagh and so on, but perhaps possibly even more so by these young Russian poets, Esenin and Mayakovsky. And I lived in, of course, I realized a very artificial world of rebellion against, I hardly knew what, but as I grew older, I got to know against what. Well, then I was brought back when I left Rugby. I left it rather prematurely. I didn't like it, and my mother brought me away, although I didn't dislike it that much. And then she sent me to Dublin to a tutor who was supposed to coach me for entrance to Trinity. Well, at that time, when I was about 17, I met at George Russell's, one of George Russell's Sunday evenings, I met Isolde Gonn, the illegitimate daughter of Maud Gonn. and was greatly attracted by her. Not perhaps immediately, there was certain peculiar fluctuations in my feelings for her, but was greatly impressed by her, and we went away to London together, and the upshot was that although the upshot was not perhaps one that either of us really wished, but because of the conventions at the time, we got married. I wasn't yet 18. Aesop was perhaps a few years older than I was. And that introduced me into a whole literary nationalist world, literary in the sense that Yeats was one of the circle into which I married, and nationalist, of course, because of my mother-in-law, Maud Gonne. Well, then gradually, of course, I began to see that this feeling of dissatisfaction, I don't know what it was a general discontent with the whole background, but it didn't lessen, funnily enough. I was discontented, had been as a youth, with the northern background. When I came to Dublin, at first I was fascinated, delighted with the setup, and then I gradually became also dissatisfied, so that when the Civil War broke out, I really believed, as I had believed in the Russian Revolution and 1916, although by then I was disillusioned with both, I believed that here was a great opportunity. And I remember one or two of us, also two or three young romantics like myself, we said, this is going now to make Ireland a place fit for such people as ourselves. We consider ourselves poets. And we threw ourselves into the Civil War. We fought and argued and were captured finally. I fought on the Republican side in the Civil War. Looking back now, it seems to me, of course, completely extraordinary that what I was fighting for was apparently De Valera's dream of this rural Ireland, the maidens dancing at the crossroads, the Irish singing, and the light ales or wine, whatever it was, sipped in strict moderation. All the things that not only have I no interest in, but I believe are, something not only banal, but which lead eventually to this horrible mediocrity which has overcome a large section of our society. But what I think, looking back, you see, my own dream was so obsessive and was probably just as strong as De Valera's dream, although I didn't have the legions on my side to enforce my dream, or we didn't, as a few of us. If we'd had the armed battalions, we might have imposed our own peculiar dream, which would have been, to my mind, a great advantage. I was captured in some street skirmishing in Dublin, and I was brought down to what was then Maryborough Prison, is now Port Leisha. We had a lot of trouble there. Went on hunger strike, burnt down the prison, we were kept out in the yard for a long period after the burning of the prison. Well, against some of our wishes, actually went back into the prison. And I remember we were playing bridge one night, and a soldier came into the cell, sent over by the governor, and handed a note to Griffin. Griffin read it, and then he said to us, we've just had news that Michael Collins has been shot dead. It was a shock to all of us. And Griffin said very little. There was another prisoner in a cell. He'd been a diplomat, a sort of Irish representative in London. I forget him, Arthur. I forget, it doesn't matter his name. And he deplored it. And I, as a very young man, not really a member of the IRA, and therefore I wouldn't give an opinion, but my friend Lane said immediately, some to the effect that a bloody good thing he had been shot dead. He was a traitor who had been softened up by Churchill and who was really one of the people who would have stepped into the shoes of the outgoing people in office and would have prospered and so on. I remember then, next morning, we were all called out into the yard, and the news of Collins' assassination or killing was read out by Joe Griffin, and there was a silence for about a moment or two, and then standing next to me was Lane, and he raised a cheer, and there was a few other cheers, but not many, but still there were some cheers. And that always has impressed me, because I think it was in some sense a turning point. I wouldn't say turning point, perhaps, but it impressed me very much that here was a man who had been heroic, who had been brave. I had known him slightly in my mother-in-law's house in Stephen's Green. That's when I know him. I was far too young and insignificant, except, you know, to greet him, and he would shake my hand. And I'd looked up to him, and suddenly I thought that he was a hero, undoubtedly a man of great courage, and yet he had been somehow corrupted. I believed then, and I believe it now, and in order not to be corrupted, it's not enough to be a hero or to be brave. You have to have some extraordinary inner integrity. Now, that has got me to a point where I suppose I began to grow up. I had other, as we all did, other vicissitudes in prison. And then came the time of after a long hunger strike. In my case, not long. Some adults much longer, but the majority of us, I think, hunger struck for about 10 to 12 days. And we were then, not immediately, but by sections on, we were released. My first wife, Isla, and myself lived in a cottage in Wicklow, and I turned to writing, first to poems, and later to novels, and because of Isolt, we knew Yeats and used to sometimes stay with him in his house in that time he was living in Merrion Square. Now, this is a period of, when I look back, comparative uneventfulness. That's to say, we lived in Wicklow pretty quietly. I was writing not very well, feeling my way, moving in certain literary circles, which I didn't, and never have, and never shall, if I live longer, appreciate. And nothing much happening. We are now speaking of about the mid-20s. Perhaps the next incident of some importance to me as a person and as a writer was a magazine that myself and Cecil Salkeld issued called Tomorrow. This was a very dissident, perhaps one of the first, now these dissident or underground periodicals are fairly common. I think they were nearly unheard of, certainly in Ireland. We issued this periodical called Tomorrow. It questioned all the values and it was out, I suppose, to shock in a way, although I think we had a very serious intent. I told Yeats about it. He was delighted to hear it, and he said he would write the first editorial for us, although we should sign it. And he did write it, and it was about the bishops and so on. When he gave it to me, I was naturally very flattered that Yeats had written this piece for us. At the same time, in my heart of hearts, I didn't like it. It was not what I had in mind. I was not out to enter into polemics with the Irish bishops or whatnot. And he went back to Aristotle and all sorts of things, which I had really no concept of. But still, we printed it. It caused an extraordinary uproar. Perhaps not extraordinary now with my present knowledge. I had really little concept that we were throwing a bombshell into all the, you know, into all the sacristies and lace curtain windows. But it really was. It denounced from the pulpits and so on and so on. We brought out a second number for which Yeats gave us his poem Leader and the Swan, I think the first publication of this poem, which also, of course, caused an uproar, and some of the articles and stories caused an uproar. I mention this because it was some slight expression of the continual and growing disillusionment I felt for the whole setup, not only perhaps in the New Ireland. We were then Free State or whatever it was, and to my mind it was no better than what had been before. Now, to go on rather quickly, then came things leading up to war. There came Hitler's Germany. Now, that struck me as previously the 1916, the Russian Revolution, the Irish Civil War, so on and so on, struck me as a possible counter force to what I saw, and I'm now speaking of the mid-30s perhaps, of what I saw as a continuing decline in the whole psychic atmosphere in which I was. When I say that, I'm thinking both of the social ambience, but particularly of literature. Now, what we had in Ireland in those days was a mainstream of Irish writing which flourished about that time, perhaps 10 years or so after our so-called independence. Daniel Corkery, perhaps, although he was now, he was one of the instigators, but by then, of course, we had Frank O'Connor acclaimed on all sides, and certain of his associates, both in Ireland and in America. It doesn't matter what had happened. Had we been, as we are now, full of... had the whole world been, you know, like on a volcano, and guerrilla groups here and other groups there, and fighting in the African forests, and Idi Amin and Arafat and Gaddafi, well, I would have gone and joined one of them gladly. But we hadn't any such opportunities. There was nobody to join. Well, I don't think I joined anybody, but I went to Hitler's Germany because I saw them as a disruptive influence. What I saw Hitler, as naive as it may seem now, I saw him as a sort of Samson who was, you know, blind, furious, going to pull down everything. What came after, I didn't care. Of course, I was completely mistaken. Hitler was not a Samson. He was quite a mediocre little man. As I learned later by watching him, watching the face, you know, the old woman's mouth and the hands always joined in. He could have worn an apron, like certain, you know, elderly women, and hands joined on the apron. No, in those days, of course, and that I only saw when I got to Germany, the Samson was Stalin. Now, Stalin was a different... I'm not going now into my own views on Stalin, which are hardly relevant. Anyway, I went to Germany. I got a job in the university. I had got it before the war, and I returned to it. It was great difficulty during the war. I'm not now... There's no question defending myself. I have nothing in one way to defend. I have been blacklisted, calumniated, or not calumniated, perhaps justly criticized for going to Germany and staying in Germany during the war. Justly, I don't know whether justly or unjustly, and I don't really care. All this business of siding with Hitler or siding with somebody else, to me, it has become largely irrelevant. I went there, I took the blame, I suffered for it, both in Germany, after the war, I was in prison. My present wife was imprisoned with me. We went through real... Not what they went through in the extermination camps. I'm not boasting of that, but in our own degree, we went through real horrors. My next objective was, of course, to get out, but with Madeleine, which wasn't... She was by then... She had... through the UNRWA, as it was then called. She had papers as a refugee, as a Pole. But even so, it wasn't easy to get out. She applied for different... there were certain countries taking these refugees, various countries. In the end, I saw the best thing I could do was go to Paris and then get her after me, which I did. I went to friends in Paris and through their help got her a job in Paris as a domestic, and shortly she could join me in Paris. This was by now, I suppose it was actually in the summer of 1949. So we lived in a small flat at the top of the house where my friends lived for about 2 or 2.5 years in Paris. A strange time, really. First normal, free world living I'd seen for quite a number of years, say 9 years, I suppose, 8 or 9 years, and the first that Madeleine had seen for many years. I then began. I had written already in Freiburg. My books were again published in England by Gollancz and in France by Edition de Soy, and we met many French writers, among them Mauriac, who I greatly respected, and lived a life of we certainly didn't have much money, but we had an extraordinary peaceful after the whole war and post-war years. We then met O'Flaherty, who was I think he'd come from America and was then living in Paris, and we saw a great deal of O'Flaherty. He used to come round and climb, I know it was 122 stairs up to our attic rooms, because I often counted them, and he would come round. There was these flags on the passage, and I'd hear him walking along. It was always very welcome. He would come perhaps to lunch. Well, I say lunch, we had simple food. But O'Flaherty loved these boiled or steamed potatoes, which you couldn't get even in the most expensive Paris restaurant. And we used to have them boiled or whatever it is, steamed, and we used to eat these with butter, and he loved potatoes. And the stories he used to tell, and Madeleine, of course, had never heard anything like these stories of O'Flaherty, and was fascinated. And then we used to go racing, and we didn't have much money, but O'Flaherty, we used to go to, not only to Longchamp, which was a little bit dearer, although nothing compared to what would be at home, we went to Longchamp at cheaper meetings where you can get in for extraordinary little. And then O'Flaherty used to say, you know, you want to keep your eyes on the ground at Paris tracks. A lot of money is mislaid or dropped. Well, I just thought it was a joke, but he said to Madeleine, you know, you keep your eyes. And it's quite true. It's most extraordinary, but that only came because of the Arabs. There was a lot of Arabs at the racetrack in those days. I think they came from Algeria. And I don't know where they got the money, but you would see them in their, they always wore tennis shoes, but usually torn tennis shoes. You'd see them going up to the guichets with thousands of franc notes, but a few hundred franc notes would fall. They wouldn't even bother to pick them up. We used to get, you know, 200 or 300 franc notes. Madeleine picks them up, and we'd have a wonderful time at these tracks. And sometimes, I remember, in the evening when we got back from the tracks, we would go to some of these rather cheaper bistros. But it was, for us, for myself, Madeleine, and I think for Liam O'Flaherty, I think it was an extremely happy time. Finally, we came back to Ireland, and we bought a cottage in County Meath and settled in there. We still, of course, had even less money, because once we bought the cottage, we had neither of us had jobs. I had my writing. I wrote anything that made money, short stories for women's magazines in London, and one such thing and another. And for some years we lived with bicycles, never got beyond the radius, say, of about 10 miles, but were happy enough in many ways. And then, through one thing or another, Madeleine, my wife, got a job in the vocational school nearby, teaching German, which was a great financial help. I began then, my novels still made little money, but I began to, I was writing in those days a long novel, which was finally published, I've mentioned already, as Blacklist Section H, but it took me years, and it wasn't naturally, that was financially rather unprofitable. I did, as I say, write stories and other things. And finally, my wife got a job in a Dublin school, also teaching German, which paid better, paid above all, was a full-time job, which meant she got holiday payment, which she wasn't getting locally. And once my blacklist was taken and published in America, I got a fair amount of money for it, and I then sold some manuscripts and letters to an American university, and we moved up to Dublin with, financially at least, some far better prospects. I have been an outcast for quite a bit of my life. I have belonged to what I used to call the ghetto. I don't think I belong to it, but my heart is there. That may sound a little bit emotional, but of course I lead to sheltered a life. I have even not a great deal, but I have had some recognition for which I'm very grateful, very generous recognition, and therefore I'm no longer an outcast. But the only thing I can say is I think I'm old enough that in my heart of hearts, whatever recognition I get, or whatever generosity of praise, it won't alter the fact that I write for outcasts largely, and I belong to a minority in the sense that I will never belong to anybody who has any power or who is a member of any power structure or institution. I know Solzhenitsyn, in one of his more remarkable statements before he became, to my mind, rather deranged in his outlook, he said, a great writer in any community is like an alternative government. Well, if that is so, and it is so, therefore, a group of good writers in any community is an alternative government. They haven't the power, naturally. They haven't the police force, they haven't the military, they don't make the laws. But they are an alternative government in the sense that they keep open certain alternatives, and that is kept open in the minds of many people who would give into despair had they no alternative offered them. This alternative may never be brought to fruition, but it is there, and even the more intelligent members of the government, of any government, know it. It's not only the Russian government who feels threatened, but any government of Western Europe who have in their midst writers of imagination and integrity, they feel always that this is, you know, a thorn in their side, and although they can't send them to Siberia or to mental homes, they would do, and do in their own way, everything to silence and suppress them.
You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. That was the Irish poet Francis Stewart from an album called Alternative Government. That was issued on Cladder Records in 1982. That was the whole of side two, which was called Biography. And coming up next is a much more recent spoken word album, a 10-inch album by ex-Fugs founder member Ed Sanders. And this is called Yiddish-Speaking Socialists of the Lower East Side.
They came when the Tsar banned the Yiddish theater in 1882. They came when the iron-tipped Cossack's whip flicked in the face of their mother. They came when their parents were cheated out of their farms in Vilna. They came to escape the peasants at Easter, hacking with scythes and knives. They came when the revolution of 1905 was crushed. They came when the soldiers broke up their socialist presses in Krakow. They fled from Siberia dungeons and work camps for printing leaflets and flyers. Pamphlets and poems and leaflets and flyers. To spread in the workshop, spread in the streets, spread in the factories. In the spirit the era had spawned. The spirit the era had spawned. Indigassen, Sudimassen. Into the streets. To the masses. They came to Antwerp and then to London and then to Ludlow Street. To make a new world. Inside the new world at century's turn. They were the Yiddish-speaking socialists of the Lower East Side. Some remembered with pangs and tears the beautiful rural life rested away. Mushroom hunting in the dampened woods. Bundles of grain in the carts, market day in the shtetl. Some strained their eyes for the gold-paved streets of the West, just to be greeted by one of those incomprehensible economic collapses that New York gives to its poor. The East Side had been slums since the overcrowding after the War of 1812. But the tenement rents of 1903 were higher than nearby better places, two-thirds of them owned by speculators getting 15% to 30% or more, so that a family of 10 was jammed in a two-room flat plus boarders, and a leafleteer in desperation lay aside his ink to open a curbside store with a gutter plank and three brown bales of rag. Or they carried the cribs to the hallway to set up a sweatshop. They were not alone. From thousands of windows came the clackety clacks of foot-treadled sewing machines, and the drum-like sounds of long-bladed scissors chewing on oaken boards, and the lungs turning gray with tidbits of tweed, and the red hot irons on the tops of the coal stoves to smooth out the bundles of cloth. And the sweet gulps of air on Cherry Street, walking out kinks of the legs at dusk from a day at the torturing treadle. A rose curled around the mallet of Pav. The Lower East Side was the strongest socialist zone in the United States for the first 20 years of the 20th century. It was a wild world of words. And everywhere, oh, the song of the wild, 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 wild lecture arose above a wild lectern. Scott Nearing at the Rand School of Social Science. Morris Hillquit at the Workman's Circle. Emma Goldman at the Educational Alliance. Eugene Debs coming in from Terre Haute to Webster Hall. And political discussions on the summertime roofs in Yiddish, Russian, Polish, and English.
It was a wild world of words, and everywhere, oh, the song of the wild, 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 wild lecture arose above a wild lectern.
Labor Day parades from East Broadway to Union Square. Cousins on the floor from fleeing Siberia after the revolution of 1905. Union meetings at the Labor Lyceum on East 4th.
Flashes of the ideal in murk, in muck, in mire.
Talking all night at the Café Royal on 2nd Avenue and 12th Street, after the Yiddish plays at the Kessler or Tomaszewski theaters. Garment worker rallies at Cooper Union, joining the Women's Trade Union League, fighting for a shorter work week, 6.5 days to 6, and then to 44 hours. On the way to 40.
Flashes of the ideal in murk, in muck, in mire, in degassen, zu demassen, to make a new world inside the new world at centuries turn. They were the Yiddish speaking socialists of the Lower East Side.
For 20 years they grew. They filled the arenas and packed the streets. Though those who stand in the bowl of shrieks know how the bowl stands silent so often when the votes are counted. But there was a party in the streets the Lower East Side had never seen the night in 1914 that Meyer London, whose father had worked in an anarchist print shop, was elected to Congress. They danced and sang through Rutgers Square past the Daily Forward till the sun blushed the color of communes above the docks. Meyer London served for 3 terms until the Democrats and Republicans in the state assembly gerrymandered his district. In 1917, the Socialist Party of New York City sent 10 assemblymen to Albany and 7 to the New York City Board of Aldermen, and even elected a municipal judge, while Morris Hillquit pulled 22% of the vote for mayor, and it looked like the socialist surge might move as a spill of thrills out through the state.
In Degassen, zu demassen, to make a new world inside the new world at centuries turn. They were the Yiddish-speaking socialists of the Lower East Side. And then in the spring of 1917, the U.S. Congress voted for war. The socialists met in St. Louis that same April and issued what was known as the St. Louis Resolution. We call upon the workers of all countries to refuse support to their governments in their wars. Some were sympathetic to the strong socialist and union movements in Germany in a struggle against czarist barbarism. Others felt it was just a distracting disturbance between Russian and German militaries. The Lower East Side was split. The pressure to support their new country was great. Not that pogroms by the Brooklyn Bridge were feared, though the dirk-tined, rioting peasant's rake was not that far in the past. The Wilson administration generated war hysteria. Scott Nearing, Eugene Debs went to jail. The government threatened the mailing rights of the Jewish Daily Forward and other socialist papers opposing the war. And then it was different after the war. There was hideous inflation, and FOB, fear of Bolsheviks, and many Mehemic forces were set against the Lower East Side socialist zone. The anti-red hysteria was nationwide. The Wobblies were crushed, the strikers of Seattle crushed, the Palmer raids, federal troops used to club down honest dispute, Emma Goldman deported, five socialists expelled from the New York legislature, and the socialist Victor Berger banned from his seat in the Congress. There was a split in the Socialist Party in 1919 and the birth of the Communist Party. You think there was factionalism in the 1960s. The factions of 1920 hissed like 35,000 ganders in an Amanita valley. And a democratic socialist in the 20s and 30s was wedged in pain among the sharp-tongued Moscow leftists and sharp-tongued bitter-shitter rightists. Oh, they failed to spread the East Side zone into a broader country of psychopathic land boomers and smug townies who thought they could hog the keys to the sky. And there was the fact that a climate of lectures and rallies can aid in the first rough forward step, but rarely the second. And they knew with all the hurt of their years how the socialist fervor fell. And the failure of those who had seen the socialist dawn to break it from sea to sea. Most of them fled the rubbly slums, and tens of thousands more. For few there are who joy to live in dirt. They joked how the ships brought the greenhorns to Rutgers Square as the moving vans took the radicals to the Bronx. For most, the game was to get out, but for some, like Congressman London, the East Side was the world in which to stay. He was there all his life, till killed by a car as he crossed Second Avenue. Shelley had Keats in his pocket. London had Chekhov. Oh, they failed, but I can hear their ghosts walk down the cobbles outside the St. Mark's Church. The poets, the strikers, the printers, the firebrands, the leafleteers. Comrades, when that word had its glow, with the passion for justice that never fades away, though heartbreak to know that they had failed to make a new world inside the new world at century's turn. They were the Yiddish-speaking socialists of the Lower East Side. La 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 la, oh new world. Indigassen and Sudamassen in the new world. They were the Yiddish speaking socialists of the Lower East Side.
Двадцатый век нас часто одурачивал, нас как налогом ложью облагали, идеи с быстротою одуванчиков от дуновенья жизни облетали, и стало нам надежной обороною, как едкая насмешливость мальчишкам, не слишком затаенная ирония, но, впрочем, обнаженная не слишком. Она была стеной или плотиною, защиту от потока лжи даруя, и руки усмехались, аплодируя, и ноги ухмылялись, маршируя. Могли писать о нас, экранизировать написанную чушь. Мы позволяли, но право надо всем иронизировать мы за собой тихонько оставляли. Мы возвышались тем, что мы презрительны. Все это так. Но если углубиться, ирония из нашего спасителя, ты превратилась в нашего убийцу. Мы дружим лицемерно, настороженно, мы любим половинчато, несмело, и кажется нам наше настоящее лишь прошлым, притворившимся умело. Мы мечемся по жизни, мы в истории, как в Фаусты заранее подсудны, ирония с усмешкой Мефистофеля, как тень за нами следует повсюду. Напрасно мы расстаться с нею пробуем, пути назад или вперед закрыты. Ирония, тебе мы душу продали, не получив за это Маргариты. Мы заживо тобою похоронены, бессильны мы от горького познанья, и наша же усталая ирония сама иронизирует над нами.
I once wrote a poem about disc jockeys. It was published in a little book of verse called Tin Pan Alley. You can get it for 5 bob. Now here's a little song about them. To my friends in the business, I would only say, if the cap fits. I'm a disc jockey, remarkably cocky, with every good reason to be. And I'll say it, though maybe I oughtn't, I'm really most frightfully important. All the teenagers, though simply outrageous, believe every word that I say. I get the new records as soon as they're in, then pick out the ones that create the most din, and the fools go and buy everything that I spin. I'm the big DJ, the big DJ. I'm a disc jockey, and aren't people lucky to have such a fellow as me? I could sell them the simplest arpeggio by plugging it over the radio. Ouch! Though my fans bore me, they simply adore me and hang on each word that I say. They sit there enraptured when I'm on the air, then write in and ask for a lock of my hair. It's part of the cross I'm committed to bear. I'm the big DJ, the big DJ. The publishers greet me with counterfeit glee. They fawn at my feet for a favor from me. That's why all my whining and dining is free. I'm the big DJ, the big DJ.
Mysterious, emotional, fantastic childhood. Apart from dying, being a child is the only human experience that cannot be told, written about, from first-hand knowledge. For after the lapse of years, the knowledge that we have from memory is no longer true and accurate, but conditioned and tempered by too much in between. Incidents are recalled, but the essential moods, thoughts, feelings are forgotten. Only a very few writers, like Proust and Tolstoy, have recaptured those undertones. The cawing of crows on a winter evening outside those nursery windows that seemed so high meant something to me that no art can explain. Not only that end-of-the-day atmosphere that to a child never loses its sweet sadness, but the end, the eve of something much larger, perhaps of childhood itself, was always suggested by that wild, harsh note. A discordant, unearthly bell tolling the end of a world, an epoch, as the firelight flickered on the wickerwork of a chair that I remembered vividly, because it too had a special significance. It had come, I was told, on the voyage with us from Australia, that I didn't remember. and it was a symbol of that past that even then was mysterious. Looking back at that past within a past, that shadow of a shadow, I come to the confines of life, trembling on the verge of a dreamlike chaos, out of which I emerged with only that chair as a tangible link, the actual in the midst of the fabulous. The firelight on the wickerwork, bright yellow round the little dark holes, and the noise of the crows outside from the withering treetops filled me with a sense of time rushing past, of being on the eve of what I only now call drably life. How high and what ultimate barriers were those garden walls? How wild and far the countryside beyond them seemed? Under the rhododendron bushes were dark leafy caves, smelling damp and sweet with an exciting fragrance. I picked up the gossamer skeleton of leaves and put them in a little box which I buried in the leaf mould under the bushes. I crumbled the rich brown mould in my hand and heard a few raindrops patter onto the flat, polished leaves above me and stayed quite still, full of sudden thoughts that were hardly thoughts so much as feelings, hardly feelings so much as a deep and hushed contemplation. But there again, there is no art to describe that childish experience. In order to do so, perhaps, one day a new one will be invented. There was a hum of insects from deep in the shrubbery, but far as I went into it, the droning always eluded me. The place from whence it came must be, I thought, the dimmest depths, the most secret spot, but I never found it. It was always there, close at hand, beyond the next bough, and yet when I stooped under it, the noise, low and intense, like the soft beat of drums, was still a little to one side or the other. One day in summer, because I remember how leafy it was, I stood by the pond that filled a hollow in a corner of the garden. Although the sun shone, the water looked dark because of the trees, a blue-black sheet. But when I knelt and put my face close to it, it was no longer a sheet at all, but transparent with the sunlight, faded a few shades to a deep bronze falling through it, and I saw the wet pebbles shining at the bottom. Not wet as they were on the gravel after a shower, or in my hand after being dipped in water, but with a mysterious perpetual wetness and sunlit at the same time. There was a bluish shadow on the bronze-coloured floor of the pond, and hanging just above the shadow, I saw a fish. Its back was a green-brown, polished and smoother than even the laurel leaves, and its gills opened and closed, and I saw the pink inside when they opened. I caught my breath. I had never before seen anything so strange and remote. Its tail was moving with a slow rhythmic sway, and beneath it the shadow trembled, but didn't vanish. In my ears there was a whisper of the leaves in the summer breeze. In my nostrils the smell of the water, cold and slightly bitter in the sweet warm air. The stones on which I knelt were hurting my knees, but I didn't move. A leaf floated past, curved at its tip like the prow of a picture book boat. But I knew I was far from picture books and make-believe. I was on the fringe of reality. I was happy and a little frightened. And I somehow knew that that was the only real way to be happy. That happiness without a touch of fear of awe isn't happiness, but contentment. I couldn't have said that, but I knew it. I knew that something in the unexpected smell of the water, in the harsh noise of the leaves, in the faint movement of the fish's tail, frightened me, and at the same time was the cause of my joy. When I got up, my knees hurt, and I was dizzy with stooping, and there was the imprint of the gravel on the soft palm of my hands, but a door had been opened to me. I couldn't have said what the secret was. I cannot say now. But I know that it was the first glimpse I had into life. beautiful in its passivity, delicate and intricate, with a savage strength.